Welcome to Launch, where we explore the world of invention and entrepreneurship. I'm Jim DeBetta, here with my co-host, Ron Reardon, and our producer, Lee Cantor.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Jim. What's
good,
happening?
Good we haven't morning, seen you. Jim. I was going to just finish it off there.
Keep saying that?
Yeah, we just keep going around the table.
That's right.
You haven't been here in a while.
Yeah, I know. It's it's scary. This, the weeks go by, things come up. It's hard, you know. And today, I'm surprised we all got here.
I had to do the backstroke.
Relatively on time, I know. It's pretty crazy. We've had enough rain.
That's it? What, 12 hours? That's enough?
I think we have. I looked at the amount of rain we had last year. In 2009, it was literally like 30 inches more than what Atlanta normally gets.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like 70-something inches, and we usually get 42 inches or something of rain. So
I think probably half of that came in 2 weeks.
And yet, are we still in a drought? I mean,
we can't be in a drought anymore.
It's been canceled. I think Lake Lanier is back up.
Back up in full. And as long as we don't give all our water away to, I guess, every surrounding state, we should be fine with water. But, not my problem, I guess. So
that's under negotiation.
It's under negotiation. All right. Well, we do have a guest, although we're kind of being rude by ignoring Brandy. Brandy Nagel. I have to say it because we just love that it rhymes with bagel. Brandy Nagel. So everyone gets that right. Got to get that out there. Brandy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Jim?
Good. I'm glad you made it in on time.
Absolutely.
Brandy, you're known as Atlanta's marketing catalyst. So you're going to have to explain to everybody exactly what that means and why you are the catalyst.
The catalyst. Well, it started out that I was part of the marketing department at Georgia Tech and working with a lot of engineers. And engineers have a respect for reputation and authenticity and accuracy, but maybe not so much marketing and branding. That's maybe not so important to them in their world. So when I used the word catalyst, a lot of the scientists and engineers at Georgia Tech could relate to that more, that I was making things happen. So it's a scientific term.
And it's a smart marketing piece, in a way, to engage those that you said aren't marketers.
Yep, I remember catalyst from my chemistry in college.
So that's a good thing. Not everyone does, but it's a good thing because it's a simple word,
right?
And it has a lot of meaning. That's the trick.
Okay, so you're a marketing catalyst.
Yeah.
You're it in Atlanta.
Yeah.
So how do you help entrepreneurs? How do you help inventors?
So a catalyst makes things happen,
right?
And what I like to do is work with small and medium-sized businesses and entrepreneurs and inventors and help them figure out what do they need to do to get their product ready for market. What do they need to do to market their product to the right customers? And I do some volunteer work as well in the community with high-tech startups, and I work with a program called MicroMentor that helps individuals that are working on starting their new venture.
Yeah, and there's definitely a need for that. You know, as many people as I talk to, I think that most people, with all the information that's out there, still don't have a handle on just how to even get started.
Yeah, that's correct.
So it's one of those situations where, hey, if you're doing that, and you're doing it on a volunteer basis, it's great because it gives people that opportunity to at least get on that right path, start doing things the right way, and then, of course, it's what they make of that and their business from there.
And where they take it. So I bet, Jim, that sometimes you talk with people, and in the back of your mind you're thinking, well, isn't it obvious? Isn't this clearly what you should do next? But it's because you have so much experience that it's obvious to you, and it's not to someone who's new to the business or starting a new venture.
Yeah, I think we all, in our respective businesses, take that for granted that, we do something day in and day out, year after year, and something might just be common sense to us. Or how could somebody not get that? But they don't get it because that's not what they do.
Exactly.
So when you're looking for getting a product ready and looking for the right customers, what's the process for determining who's the right customer?
Oh, okay. So I have an interesting story to tell about this. I recently had a consultation with a caterer, and I asked him, who is your ideal client? And he said, well, anyone who eats.
Nice.
Do you like that answer?
That's a little broad.
Limits it down to a few people. All right.
So an end user is not the same as a customer. The person who makes the buying decision is really the customer, the person you need to talk to, right?
Bingo.
But in his world, he's a very successful caterer, has been doing this for over 25 years. Boy, it was not clear to him that he should be focusing on mothers of the bride, for example, instead of everyone who might attend a wedding.
Right. Well, when you go to a wedding, one of the things people always talk about, good or bad, is the food. I mean, that's what you, or the music. You know, people, you know, they get together, they sing people they know. But I've, that's what people always say. Oh, it was a great wedding. The food was great, or, you know, the food was crappy. And that's one of the things they remember about a wedding, unfortunately.
Yeah, to me, you know, one of the elements of the you know, the target customer is that the person that writes the check.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so that would seem really obvious, right, to someone who's in marketing and sales, that you talk to the person who can make the buying decision. And yet, it's not obvious to everyone. And someone who has a great idea can be very knowledgeable about that idea and not about how to market it.
Then what makes him so successful, this caterer? If he's been doing this 25 years, is it just the food is that great, and so it's word of mouth? Or what was he looking for specifically from you to help him
grow his business?
Yeah, so his success is based on great quality food and great service. And I think they have a reputation for consistency. Their prices are competitive. They're not a low-price provider. But so they've got that great foundation. Hmm. But this particular person is trying to figure out how to use social media, which is a very affordable way for a small business to promote themselves. How to use social media to start to grow the catering business, which is great because he could place a Facebook ad and really target his demographic exactly down. But again, it goes back to knowing who your customer is. His demographic he was thinking was anyone who eats. Well, that's pretty much everyone on Facebook, right?
Right.
Yeah, but it's really not. It's really a much smaller part of that. And he can target that on Facebook. It's just figuring out who is the right person with the checkbook.
Yeah, like you said, if he's targeting like a certain niche, like weddings or corporate events or parties for whatever particular
reason.
Bar
mitzvahs, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you're right. It's, these are all basic things that you'd say, well, somebody's successful, but maybe it's in spite of themselves, and maybe they just have great food, great service, but they want more, mm-hmm. and they have to keep that business going, and they have to find out how to grow and advertise that business through social media and other means that are more modern than, you know, sending out a mailer to, you know, 50,000 homes and it costs you a fortune.
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't realize that yet. We know that there are better ways and more cost-effective ways to do things like that. So
I'm starting to think of advertising as the last resort.
Yeah, I think, you know what I'm seeing, Brandy, a lot is, you know, people getting in their own PR space, like, you know, be your own voice, go out there. And a lot of that is through social media. It's mm-hmm. not about, well, I'm a caterer. Here's here's what I got to sell. Here's my price. It's more about this person writes about food or writes about, you know, the importance of having, you know, your event go off perfectly. And food is an integral part of that versus just shoving, you know, a sale down somebody's throat, which, you know, doesn't necessarily work on social media.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm with you on the advertising because I know that when I first launched my business, I would advertise in magazines and trade newspapers and like that, and I got zero customers from that. Word of mouth seems to work a whole lot better for me.
You know, that's like the best kept secret in the marketing world, is that word of mouth continues to be the oldest form of advertising and the most successful form of marketing and the least expensive if you do it right. I mean, this could put the marketing industry out of business in a way, but word of mouth is so powerful.
Well, and with the internet, word of mouth is just, you know, type in a little, you know, hey, Ron, I got this. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Versus me having to call Ron on the phone or see him in person. You're right. I mean, it's PR in a way. I mean,
yeah, third person referrals is strong. Yeah. It really is, because people usually come to you or pre-sold, you know.
But the trick is, and always will be, the product has to be good to begin with.
Sure. Yeah, all things being relatively equal, right. But if, you know, if I, you know, have somebody that calls me and they need a patent agent, you know, I say, you know, talk to Ron. He's the best. Yeah, Ron, you know, most of the time is not going to have to sell that person. It's just whether that person wants to spend the money to go through the process.
Yeah.
But they call up Ron already saying, all right, Ron's my guy, but I got to find out how much it costs, or, you know, what it's really about. And, mm-hmm. you know, so that's not going to change. I don't see that being any different.
True. So what are some of the key questions that entrepreneurs need to ask themselves, Brandy?
I think there's a couple of questions. And one is, what do they want to get out of what they're doing? Is it fame, fortune?
Money.
Is it money?
Yeah, they all want money.
Are they wanting freedom, that they don't want to be working for the man anymore? What is it that's important to them? And so that's kind of like the personal discussion that an entrepreneur or an inventor has to figure out for themselves. The next thing is, you know, how do you figure out the path to success? Who's going to be part of your tribe and help you figure out how to take your idea to the next level? And I think an important question is, how are you going to protect your idea? Is your idea something that anyone can pick up and run with? Or is it something that's very specific? Do you need a patent? You know, do you need to be very confidential in your business conversations and have non-disclosure forms? I think that's a question that does not automatically come to an inventor's mind necessarily when they've got their great idea.
Yeah, well, you know, when you see people that want to go in their own businesses, they, you know, everybody wants to, or seemingly wants to, own their own company, have freedom, and whether that's financial freedom or more family time. But, you know, that's one of those decisions where, you know, somebody's personal life or interests, you know, when you really start digging, you find out what they're capable of, or they're in a situation where they can or cannot get into business. But just being aware of that, everyone sees the success stories and the dollar signs, but they don't see that it takes discipline to be home and work from a home office, or it takes dedication to get a business. You know, when you work for a big company, the infrastructure's there.
Yeah.
You just kind of show up, sit down, do your thing. But when you do it on your own, it could take a year, 2 years, 5 years or more to build a business.
I think that's all true. And I think that there's a different emotional state when it's your own business.
Oh, yeah.
The failures hurt a lot more. The wins feel a lot better.
That's true.
There's no safety net on the failure side, right? You work for a company. If you screw up something, well, you may not get fired, but at least, you know, there's something there to back it up. But
yeah, there's no ceiling, but there's no floor.
Right.
Yeah.
Brandy, when you're working with the people at Georgia Tech, is it a different mentality than when you're working with, like, the caterer?
Yeah. So the entrepreneurs and the inventors that I work with at Georgia Tech, their products tend to be very technical or scientific. There's one gentleman who has created a product that I think could revolutionize the HVAC industry. And I'm under a confidentiality agreement, so I can't talk about it, but it's something interesting.
We won't say anything. Don't worry.
Oh, it's just between us?
Yes.
No, well, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
and the whole internet.
Don't say anything. Yeah. HVAC, good. All right, got it.
Yeah. So the folks that I've met through Georgia Tech, very scientific, engineering-oriented, and there's a lot of internet business that's coming out of Georgia Tech. There's a startup accelerator based out of Tech called ATDC, the mm-hmm. Advanced Technology
yeah,
Development
we
Center.
Know it.
And they just have some amazing products, amazing businesses coming out of there.
Well, you know, a cousin to the question you were, said earlier about, you know, what do they want from the business? Another way I've heard that expressed is the first question you should ask when you start a business is how you plan to exit the business. You know, do you plan to sell it, you know, give it to your kids, you know?
Take it to an IPO,
exit strategy. I mean, you know, investors won't invest unless there's an exit strategy. If I invest in your business, I got to know when I'm getting my money back. And it can't be, well, you know, we'll see what, no, it's 3 year, 5 year, 10 years. There's got to be an exit strategy for me to invest in your business so I can gauge when I'm getting my money out. And that's for any of these businesses.
Yeah, because, you know, part of that question is, you know, are you going to need, you know, patents? Are you going to keep it as a trade secret? And, you know, are you going to have a tremendous list of clients, you know, that you'll be able to interest somebody in, you know, when you actually exit the business?
I like that idea. I think that one of the underrated or unknown strategies is licensing. And I've talked with Jim about this before, right, that if you have an invention, pulling a great brand to sit with that invention can be very powerful, and the license agreements can go different ways. So it might be that I'm taking the invention to a big company and they're paying me a royalty, or it might be that I go to a company with a great brand and I pay them a small royalty to use their brand. And that's something that's kind of underused.
It is. I mean, I was involved in both scenarios back in my binocular days. And yeah, and only because somebody mentioned to me, you know, it's kind of like double dipping. You can have your own product company and sell your products under your own brand, but at the same time, you could take a new line of your products. I can go to, you know, Ron Reardon, Inc., you know, maybe he's a big consumer brand, and I can do a licensing deal with him so I could use his brand on my new line of products. He's got more awareness. I could sell more products. So licensing deals work both ways. It's people that are in business. Big companies do licensing deals all the time. Everyone thinks it's like just inventors doing licensing deals, but you know, you see a lot of action at you know, the big corporate levels.
So how would an inventor get involved in that if they were interested?
Well, I mean, in short, in licensing, obviously, like Brandy was mentioning, if you've got an invention idea, I mean, certainly, you know, you'd want to talk to Ron in that sense. You know, you need to get with a patent agent or attorney to find out A, is your idea even patentable? If it's not, then you really don't have much leverage in a licensing deal. If you come to me, Lee, with a product idea,
right,
and, you know, I do a search and find out that, you know, it's, you know, either it's already patented or, you know, it could be easily be run around. I mean, Ron, you know all the specifics of that type of stuff. Then why would I want to do a deal with you? I'm going to spend all the money and time marketing
and promoting
a product only to find out that, you know, company B can come along
jump
and just
right
make
in.
The same thing.
Yeah, because, Lee, one example of an inventor doing licensing that I'm familiar with is the lady that invented the French twister. And there's a device that would, you know, very quickly put your hair into a French twist.
Right.
And she licensed it to Scrunchy, who already had some hair products,
right,
but they didn't have that one, and it just fit real well, and she licensed it to them.
Yes, I know her. I met her at where do we see her?
Invent Bay.
Yeah, Invent Bay. That's right. Yeah, she actually has a nice little book on the process. You know, her story
of
and all
creating
that.
Her product,
yeah,
or the licensing.
Yeah, I bought that book.
It's but obviously, brand. you have to do a thorough patent search. It's got to be done right.
Could it just be the brand? Can people license the brand, or do they have to actually have some sort of an invention?
No, I mean, look at all the big brands you see today. I mean, you know, that you wear, like Disney or something. I mean, they put their name on any toy company's toys, and, you know, moms and dads are buying it. So,
right.
You know, there's really nothing there, but...
But if somebody wanted to, say they had a strong brand, how would they go about the licensing? Do you have to hire somebody that's an expert in this?
Yeah, there's actually a couple of people here in Atlanta that do just that. They're consultants to manufacturers or inventors who have a product and want a brand for it. And I think that's a good way to start, because there's a lot of legal mumbo jumbo that gets involved in those agreements. So I think that's one that you'd want to have
a
professional.
Do it yourself.
No.
I don't have a problem with somebody. They have to learn the business of licensing. I mean, you have to. I don't care if you take a great course, you hire somebody to teach you. I don't have a problem with somebody taking an invention idea that's patentable or patented and going to a corporation and trying to get a licensing deal. But on the other side of that desk are very experienced people who do licensing deals that will, you know, unfortunately, potentially take advantage, get the better end of a deal, create an agreement that's more or less lopsided. So I don't have a problem with somebody making the effort to be their own advocate for their own product idea. But, yeah, you can't sign an agreement without, you know, I definitely urge people to have an attorney look at an agreement, sign an agreement. You know, licensing agent, patent attorneys, you can't get into those things or else you can...
Yeah, and Lee, there's the Licensing Executive Society at LES.org, and that's a worldwide organization, and most of the really qualified licensing folks, you know, belong to that organization.
So they work with patent people?
Yeah, they do.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brandy, how can personal branding help an inventor take their product to market?
So, I think what's interesting is that sometimes an inventor or an entrepreneur is looking for funding, right?
They need money, yes.
People with money are not going to give it to forgettable people. I think that's what personal branding means in this context, is doing something that makes you memorable to the person who has the checkbook.
I like that. Is that a Brandy Nagel original? Or
that's a Brandyism, yeah.
Brandyism, all right, cool, all right. Nice.
And memorable in a good way.
Memorable in a good way.
Or does any way matter?
So there's a handful of points, and I actually teach a class to job seekers along the same lines, that if you're looking for something to happen, the person who makes the decision on that, whether it be a hiring decision or an investment in your company, they need to be able to remember you in a really positive way. They should be remembering you for your competency, or that you're an articulate person, whatever it is that makes you very good at what you do. That's what you have to give people, sort of a handle that they can grab onto and keep you in their memory.
I agree with that. I mean, when I was in the binocular business, when we hired people, I would have, you know, like the national sales manager, for example, interview the first round of potential salespeople. And then I said, when you got it down to, you know, 3, 4, 5 people, then I want to meet them for 10 minutes. And if I didn't instantly like somebody or felt like they were going to fit in culturally wise to the company, I don't care if they had a degree from Harvard, I don't care how much sales experience, I wouldn't hire them. Because you got to work with these people every day. And people buy and hire from, you know, people that they like. I mean, that's nothing new. So, you know, I think that's important.
So what are some tips to build your personal brand?
I think a lot of it is built on who you are really as a person. So if you create an artificial brand, that is not sustainable. That would be acting. So it starts with who you are as an actual person, and that might have to do with your personal faith or what you love to do as a hobby. It might be what you prefer, how you prefer to dress, or your preferences on how you present yourself. So whatever those elements of your personality are, that's the great place to start and to develop your brand from that. And we're on radio, so I'll mention I'm wearing glasses that have green arms and a green sweater today. And probably every time I've met Jim, he has seen me wearing green. And this isn't artificial. I just happen to really like green. And so that's part of my brand now, is a color preference, which, if you think about it, Coca-Cola has a color.
Right.
UPS has a color. Color's a really powerful
way. Has a color. Yes, that's true. That? I think
it's subtle. So, like, your website would have green, like, everything associated, your business card?
Yes, in fact, they do.
And you know that colors are trademarkable, because John Deere owns that particular color of green for tractors.
I did not know that.
Nobody else can make a tractor with that
shade
of green.
Ron's doing deals right here. Patent and trademark deals right here on the radio show.
That color green, Brandy, watch out.
Oh,
Ron's
going to
get a patent on that.
No,
you're going to be out of luck.
No, she can have her color green, because it's not exactly the same as a John Deere green. And plus, it's not for tractors.
Yeah, John Deere green is a look at darker.
It's darker.
Grassy.
Yeah.
Kind of green, right?
Yeah. Actually, in the trademark, it actually talks about what exact green that is.
Okay? Oh, yeah, the Pantone color.
Right. I'm sure Coca-Cola red is a special red.
Bingo.
And, you know, if you saw the Coca-Cola logo in blue, you'd give it a double take and think, what's wrong with that? Because we are so accustomed over the years to always seeing Coca-Cola in red and white. And so personal branding, it follows those same principles, is whatever it is that you want to express, it's important to be consistent with that.
Yep, like the Home Depot,
it's an orange. Yep, that's right.
Yep, you think about it. If you actually sit down and think about how many different brands are color-driven, well, that's how you would recognize them.
Right.
There's a lot. You know, you mentioned, Brandy, one thing that was interesting. You said about personal beliefs. Now, I've had people come to me in the past, and they're very religious. And, you know, to me, for somebody to come in and you know, be religious, so to speak, you know, in an interview and everything is, you know, God-based or something, to me was like, you know,
yeah.
I mean, look, believe in whatever you like. That's not my business at all. But, you know, some people are uncomfortable with that. And if you work in a company where everybody is just, I guess,
they have to find that right culture that matches that.
Yeah,
I mean,
if
imagine.
Everything is about that, or you, when somebody does something wrong, it becomes a religious,
right?
You know, that would can hurt,
right?
You know, morale in a company.
I think religion and politics, you know, you got to be careful with that.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, there are some companies I'm thinking of in particular, Chick-fil-A,
absolutely,
that part of their business is faith and family. So that would be a good fit for someone who that's part of their personal values, right? But there's lots of companies where the workplace is very secular, and what you do on the weekend is not really anyone's concern. I think just having some awareness of that is important. And I also think that you can keep your personal brand and your personal values inside of you, act on them all the time. You don't have to talk about them necessarily if you think it'll make other people feel uncomfortable.
And I think that's the key, where, you know, that shouldn't be the center of why I'm hiring you, or it's not a reason I'm going to hire you or whatever. But, you know, some people are, like you said, they're very focused in on that. And so I guess if you just wear green and show up, we know that's brand.
And I actually
so.
Heard a talk from the current president of Chick-fil-A, where he said that one of the strongest ways that they can recruit young people to work in their stores is they know that on Sunday,
close on Sunday,
that they can be with their friends. Mm-hmm. They might not necessarily go to church, but they know they're going to have Sunday off.
Yeah.
And that was a real strong recruitment strategy for them.
And they're good. You ever go through like a drive-through? Yeah. They really have it down right.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the best, no doubt about it.
Right.
I like the manners that their employees have.
Yeah. And, you know, my next-door neighbor owns the Chick-fil-A down on Johnson Ferry, and I talk to him about it once in a while, get in a conversation with him, and he said that, yeah, hiring for them is easy. It's they always have more applicants than they need. They pay them well, and they train them. It's not faith-based training, but it is definitely, you know, more like values and yes, sir, yes, ma'am, mm-hmm. thank you, have a nice day. Whereas, you know, I've gone to drive-thrus and other
fast food
and
your
and
mind.
They'll just, you know, almost throw in the bag.
They're doing you a favor.
Yeah, you know.
That's
right.
true. Well, Brandy, social media. How can entrepreneurs and inventors use social media to promote their product or business?
Oh, this is a great topic. So I think that social media, we might just now be passing out of the puppy love phase, because social media has been the hot buzzword for a while now. And I think now I'm starting to hear more about return on investment and how do we measure success and so on. I think what entrepreneurs and inventors can do is spread the word about what they're doing with one caveat. I think once you put something out in social media, it's out there for a long, long time. It doesn't ever go away. It's searchable. And I think with regards to the intellectual property, it's important to be protective of your idea and not reveal too much. But the power of social media is being able to broadcast a message, share it with lots of people, and let it get out there. So what specifically an inventor might do is they might make an effort maybe once a month to put an update on Facebook or on LinkedIn to give an update about where they are with their business, where they are with their invention, and use that to connect with people and start to build a support system.
Yeah, I see a lot of inventors that have blogs, and they're not always very active, but yeah, it's the same thing. It's like their personal journal, my story. Here's what I've started. Hey, you know, last month I finally got my prototype made, or my website is up or something. But you're right. I mean, but it's the trick is, for anybody in any business, getting people to notice you, to follow you, and that's not always obvious. I mean, you always hear, don't try to sell your products. Don't just try to be a friend to everybody. But then that takes time. I mean, you can't sit on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours a day if you're going to start up a successful business. But yet, it's got to be a part of your day, because without that, you can't reach all the people that you want to reach. So yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, I know that when job seekers have to be real careful with Twitter, especially if they put something on there of, you know, I really hate my job and I'm going to go look for another one, and then their boss finds that on Twitter, and then they're canned, you know.
Yeah, that's a career-limiting move. Yeah, that's bad. I think it's really important for people to remember what goes on social media doesn't ever go away. So yeah.
Google is forever.
Google is forever.
Yeah, it's kind of a frightening little thing. But, well, you know, at least you can control it, though. I mean, you can control what you put out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have that positive message and you're trying to reach people. But it's no secret, Brandy, I think, to anybody that marketing ultimately becomes the real source of success. I mean, Ron, we see it in the product business. We see products that we look at and we think these things could never go anywhere. But the marketing, the packaging, the messaging is so strong that it resonates with the right audience. And all of a sudden people are buying whatever that is. And you say, how in the world could that, like... Yeah, you know, there's just so many products that fall into that.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind for me is the Hercules hook and Mighty Putty, you know, things like that. I mean, they're really good marketing.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, that's it. It's a good message. The names are catchy. Mm-hmm. You know, they people talk about it. It's that, you know.
Have you guys ever seen an example where there was a product that maybe was going nowhere and then they renamed it or they changed it a little bit and then all of a sudden it became super successful? So, meaning that the product wasn't really the problem. It was just how it was...
Well, I think the Slankit and the Snuggie is an example.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of products that, you know, from a public consumer visual standpoint, people don't see it. Like they may come out with something, it's not really known to people, but then they quickly change the name because they're not getting a reaction. And then you know the name that
and then
you
it takes
say.
Off.
Yeah,
right.
I think that happens a lot. Definitely. I can't think of any specific examples.
Right, but I think Ron was referring to this. The Snuggie used to be called the Slankit.
Right.
Like I saw that in Sky Mall, you know, probably a year before it became the Snuggie.
Yeah, and great marketing, good infomercial, right?
And off it goes. How many did it sell? 50 million?
And now it's in animal prints, and you get buy one for your dog.
There
you go.
Kids,
the college team.
Yeah, it's going crazy.
So, Brandy, what resources exist in Atlanta to help entrepreneurs and inventors get started and grow their business?
Well, one of my favorites is a group called Startup Chicks.
Okay.
And I've talked with Jim about this a little bit. It started out as a way for women in technology who were involved with startup companies to get together and maybe have a glass of wine.
How is that a big group of women in technology? Is like what percentage of technology companies have women?
It's a low number.
Is it 30%?
No.
No, I don't think it's that.
No.
10?
I'm going to say it's around 10 or maybe less. And as a way to calculate it, or maybe as an example, at some of the recent technology events,
right,
there might be 100, 110 people, right, and three will be female.
Wow.
But I think it's growing. I know it's growing.
I know it's growing. Yeah. And actually, there's just a movement right now for the next Barbie that has a profession, you know,
really?
Like astronaut Barbie,
right,
to be a computer engineer to help promote, wow, the idea of technology, oh, for, oh, for young,
cool,
women.
Yeah, I know from a patent standpoint that female inventors on patents is less than 10%, something,
yeah,
like 7%, but it's been growing. It's increasing.
Oh, good. Okay.
It is increasing.
Yeah, and just in the people that I talk to, you know, more and more and more, a vast majority of my clients are women in all types of products. It's not just they made something for the kitchen or, you know, a cleaning product. It's,
right,
it's technology. It's anything.
Okay, so. But Jim, let me ask you a question about that. Do you think part of that is because women are receptive to hiring a coach or working with a consultant and getting help for growing their business?
I think it's Jim's sex appeal.
Yeah.
It could be. I wasn't going to bring that up, but
people have seen his blog and thought a lot about
it. Jay? Well, Jay's not here. Okay. So, you know, I think it is. There are a lot of forum discussions about, you know, women and you know, and I've learned from other women that women want to get down to business quickly. They don't want to, like, go golfing and spend, you know, 3 weeks, you know, hanging out and having, you know, glasses of wine. They want to quickly get down to work. But I think it's just there's an overall movement, especially on the internet, for mompreneurs, you know, startup, mm-hmm, chicks, this, you know, and a lot of these groups are women-driven. A lot of them are obviously run by women, or just about all the women groups are, you know, there's Ladies Who Launch, there's, you know, I mean, there's just so many organizations that because of the internet, they're getting a lot more airtime and play, mm-hmm,
And the internet plays well with them because they like to collaborate and they like to,
yeah,
connect. So all that kind of creates that groundswell, I think, of support. And they,
yeah,
all,
and that's what it is. It's a support system that, you know, there's more encouragement for women to not think that, you know, it's just a man's world, that we have ideas and we can get products out there. And it's once they get started, the process,
yeah,
it's no different for a man or a woman. It's patents and it's prototypes and it's marketing. And I am seeing a much greater influx of women for probably all these reasons, and I don't think it's going to stop. And you hear the buzz; it's a hot,
yeah,
thing right now. Mompreneurs and womenpreneurs. There's dozens of different little monikers for them. But
I think also the economy, you know, it's in flux, and now women are, you know, the main breadwinner in a lot of families.
Mm-hmm.
So the pressure's on. You,
yeah,
know, they have to get out there. Now's the chance, really, to take that chance. And
yeah, so that's interesting to me because this downturn in the economy, I think of it as a recalibration. And I've heard so many people talk about, I've been working this kind of a job for so long. It's not what I love. Now,
right,
is the time.
Hey, now's as good a time as any to
yeah,
do it on my own, to take a shot.
And it's kind of counterintuitive to think that during a low time in the,
right,
economy that you would launch a business, but yeah, why not? There's probably not a better time.
Right, but the risk is relative because they feel like stagnating in their previous job, and they're like, why did I waste all these years doing something I didn't like?
Yeah.
So I might as well take the shot.
Yeah.
And Microsoft started during a recession.
Oh, that's right. Huh.
Yeah, there were a bunch of, right, big companies that started out. I can't think of the names, but
and there's a lot of brain power out there that's looking for opportunities. So
that's
this
true.
Is a good opportunity for a small growing business.
That's true.
You know what it is? I think the overall thing for me is that because there are so many of these womenpreneur groups, they feel empowered now. There's an internal support amongst women,
mm-hmm,
to do more things.
And they're seeing it with their eyes, people thriving in this. So then they're like, well, I can do this.
Yeah, know? They've always, I mean, I don't think there's been any less desire in the past for women to get into business in these types of businesses that we're in. It's just that everything was male dominated. All the groups and associations and organizations were men based. So now that there's these women organizations, like say like a Startup Chicks, they have a place to go,
mm-hmm,
to collaborate and work and seek out resources, and the whole organization lifts up,
yeah,
everybody. And that's, I think that's the
What's the group didn't you found one of these groups?
I founded Atlanta Social Media Enthusiasts,
mm-hmm,
and it's focused really on LinkedIn,
mm-hmm,
and providing education for people who are interested in social media but don't necessarily want to be experts.
Right.
I kind of reject the expert,
yeah,
title with social media, mm-hmm, because it hasn't been around long enough for anyone to be a guru yet.
Now, so what do you have meetings or it's all online?
It's all online.
Mm-hmm.
So, Randy, what's the biggest mistake a person can make when trying to launch their product or business?
I think taking advice from the wrong person. So
that's a tough one. how do you know who the wrong person is?
Yeah, so I have a couple of examples of inventors who had a niece or a nephew create their website. And the
relative with the web skills.
Yeah.
That always ends badly.
And it looks very homemade. That's the nice way to say it, right? I think it's a mistake to count on your family and friends as your only source of advice and mentoring. I think it's much better. You'll get better results if you engage with some of the local groups like Startup Chicks or the Inventors Club in Atlanta. Listen to some other people and sort of weigh the advice you're receiving.
And then compare that to your brother-in-law.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to be objective. I mean, you need objective opinions. I always tell inventors that the worst advice they're going to get is from their family and friends, the people that love them. That
the worst advice.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, if I go to, my one of my brothers or something and say, I've got an invention, they're going to say, oh, Jim, it looks cool, it looks great.
Your brothers are going to say that?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, if I did, I would imagine. But I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
Everybody that calls me says the same thing. Well, my friends love it. My family thinks this is awesome. And then, we'll launch some consumer surveys and only, 20-30% of people really like the product.
Right.
And, I mean, it's not to say that the family members are going to just outright sugarcoat and lie about everything, but they're going to be supportive.
They're going to err on the side of being supportive.
They don't want to hurt your feelings.
Especially if they're the ones lending you the money to get your
business
running. Well,
you would think,
they're going to definitely be very encouraging, and that's dangerous. I mean, you want those opinions, but you cannot grow a business or start a business based on those opinions.
Right, so you need a stranger to like
your
stuff.
Very objective. Or I had somebody that called me not that long ago that said they said, well, I didn't ask my family and friends. They stood in a mall. And, people walk by, they say, well, what do you think of this? I created this. I'm like, well, that's the same thing. I mean, if you come up to me in the mall, I don't want to be rude. I'm going to probably say, oh, yeah, it looks great. I'm going to keep walking. I may then go, oh, my God.
What an idiot, right?
But, I mean, I said, that's just as bad, if not worse, because it's a biased situation.
Right, so they thought they were being unbiased.
Right, they said, well, I talked to 500 people, and, 430 thought it was awesome. I said, well, That means zero to me.
I have this exact same situation with a client that they've invented a thingamajig, and they've done some product testing within their circle of family and friends and had great feedback.
Right.
And I've said, that's a great place to start, but how about if you give me 20 samples of the product and let me put it out with family and friends of mine?
Right.
Where there's no interest
there's no emotional connection.
Yeah, there's no fear of hurting feelings. And the feedback that I've got, fortunately, has been good for the product.
Well, that's good. An encouraging thing.
Well, Brandy, one last question. Pricing is always a tough decision. Do you bargain basement, premium?
How do you decide which pricing tier to go?
Yeah, so there's a book that I love. It's called How to Sell at Prices Higher Than Your Competition. And I think every inventor, every entrepreneur should read this. The author is Larry Steinmetz, and I was lucky enough to hear him a couple of years ago do a presentation. And one of the ideas he talks about in the book is that all companies are slowly going out of business. And the trick is for you to go out of business more slowly
last
than your competition.
It's like when you're being chased by a bear.
Right.
You just have to be a little
faster
than the other guy with you.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. And I think this is a really powerful idea for entrepreneurs. Competing on price really is not good for entrepreneurs.
That's not good for anybody.
You really need to show the value of your product, and how you price your product conveys to your customer how valuable you think it is.
Right.
And this is also true for small businesses and freelancers and so on. Don't be afraid to charge a higher price.
Right, as long as the benefits and values.
Yeah.
And that's when it comes down to a marketing, a branding message, packaging. I always use the Tiffany blue box as a perfect example of it doesn't matter what they put inside that box. It looks like it's $1 million. And when you get that as a gift, you automatically think the person spent a fortune on it. And obviously their pens and other things are more expensive than average pens. But I don't know if they're that much better exponentially in terms of price than
else. Ron, here's a question for you. Do you know if Tiffany's has patented the color blue that they use for their boxes?
I don't know that. I'd have to look that one up.
That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Because it has a lot of power, the color of the blue box.
Sure,
that's true. that's true.
And Ron didn't know that.
No.
I'm a little shocked.
You've stumped the Ron here.
He will be reporting back.
But I will go check out Tiffany's and the color blue, though.
Yeah, so that all ties into pricing and you know, perception and all the big brands in any business. It's all about perception, and they start high. It's easy to be high price and lower your price.
You can't go the other way.
Mm-mm. You can.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that Godiva chocolate at the beginning was at commodity pricing, and they decided to many, many, many years ago to rebrand and have the aura, you know, that it's really high-end chocolate and to elevate the price.
Do you know that I just saw something about Godiva just the other day that they've now introduced a lower-priced line of chocolates to meet the consumer demands of the economy.
Is it still called Godiva? Or they
Yeah, oh, it's, you know, it's Godiva, and they
Godiva
showed the package.
Like.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. And it was some kind of a special name. It was like Godiva, you know, whatever, select something. Mm-hmm. And they said that the equivalent package of chocolates that they were selling now, they were like $1.60 a chocolate, like when you bought the pack.
Right.
These are like 60 cents a chocolate. So it's a value price, not cheap. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're still paying $10 for a little box of chocolates, but the other one was like, you know, $18. So they're listening to their customers. They're saying, we want Godiva. We love your chocolate, but we can't afford.
Right. It'll be interesting to see if that erodes their brand over time, though.
Well, when I looked at the package they showed, I mean, it looks beautiful. It looks nice. But, well, look at all the car companies like, you know, Mercedes and BMW. They used to only sell very expensive cars. Now they got they're selling cars for $20,000. So.
Right.
You know, I always thought that was a sellout. I'm like, oh, how could, you know, Mercedes, it sold, you know, $80,000 cars, now selling, a C-Class to everybody.
Well, because if you're the guy who buys the $80,000 car, that's not making you feel special and good when you see the guy who mows your lawn driving the same car.
They realize that they're only selling, you know, a little tiny percentage, and now they can, you know, it's still a little aspirational.
It's a risk, though.
It's very risky, but, you know, it seems to work, so we'll see how.
Well, on the other end of that, have you noticed the premium M&Ms?
Yeah.
They're in a special little package, and there's not many in there, and, you know, the package looks nice,
it's
really expensive M&M.
That's silly?
That's just silly. Come on. I mean, it's an M&M. I mean,
I bought them, okay?
No,
worked for me.
See, it's great marketing. See, they sucked Ron in. So, all right, Brandy, where can people find you on the web?
www.conversationsnotcampaigns.com.
Conversations with an S. Conversationsnotcampaigns.com.
That's okay. It. And you can find me also on LinkedIn.
Of course.
Okay. And I'll link into you later today.
Oh, good. Good.
Okay. Well, this has been another exciting issue of Launch for entrepreneurs and inventors with Jim DeBetta, our producer Lee Cantor, and our special guest Brandy Nagel, signing off.
Thank you.